and welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate the overlooked, ignored, derided, or the just plain hated. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, marine life, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is the writer and scuba diving journalist, Chris Mitchell. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
So this is going to be another of our non-pop culture, as it were. I mean, we're going to touch on pop culture because it's inevitable. You can't talk about this without discussing pop culture. But yeah, so just tell us what you've come on the show to talk about. Give us some, you know, context around it and, you know, why it's maligned and then why you think, of course, that that is wrong.
So I wanted to come on today to talk about great white sharks, who are the most unjustly maligned of all sharks, but also they are kind of the standard bearer of the fear that human beings feel about sharks in general. And there's over 100 different species of shark, but the great white is the one that gets all the attention because of, obviously, movies like Jaws, which have managed to amplify the fear that humans feel about sharks to the point now where, we as a human race are decimating the amount of sharks that live in our oceans, and in the process eroding our own balance of nature and causing ourselves big problems in the future. Plus, besides all that, sharks are nice, and we should leave them be, I think.
Okay, so straight away, sharks are nice? I mean, so yes, I know, I think most people know that great whites have got a bad rap because of Jaws. And the, you know, they don't actually actively seek out people to attack and hang around, you know, slaughtering innocent swimmers. And obviously lots of fiction has followed the lead of Jaws. And as you say, great whites have kind of become a standard bearer for not just sharks, I think just for the sea in general. Like, you know, when you think of danger at sea, you think of sharks. But at the same time, they have been known to attack people. So, you know, they're not that friendly. So,
sure. But you could say the same of tigers, couldn't you? Or dogs, for that matter. In fact, probably more people die of being attacked by dogs than they do by sharks. There's only about 11 to 15 people a year killed by sharks on average. It's gone up the last couple of years. But if you think of the amount of people that are killed by sharks versus all the other ways you can die, then you see that the fear that is given to them is utterly disproportionate. But there's also, like you say, there's the main issue of the fact that most of these deaths, in fact, pretty much all of them, are not because of sharks being some malevolent killer. And now you say that most people realise that, but I'm not actually sure that's the case. If you look at the way that the media portrays sharks, and I don't just mean movies. Obviously, we're just about to have our latest campy summer blockbuster, Meg, with Jason Statham, which is all going to be about a prehistoric shark waking up and coming back to cause terror, the inevitable terror.
Is that about a sea megalodon or something?
That exactly, yes. Is that the
right.
Prehistoric shark? Yes,
I hadn't heard
which
of
is
that,
which
but,
is that's based on a yeah. It's all set to come out in a couple of months, I believe. And that's based on a series of books that came out, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago. I mean, megalodons are fascinating creatures. I mean, they're extinct, thank God.
Because they were absolutely enormous, weren't they? The size
they
of a
were,
bus.
That's right. Yes, two buses, possibly. I mean, just really, really big. And the teeth of those sharks still are found in all sorts of places, in places that are now completely devoid of any water, so you know, in desert ridges and stuff like that. And when you see the teeth, they're remarkable. They're each tooth is like sort of bigger than your hand. It really is sort of like confronting a mouthful of butcher's knives or whatever. But all that aside, the reason for sharks to sort of get less of a bad rap and to be considered as something more beautiful is the sense of they are like the perfect machines for their environment, and they're not just killing machines, which is what we always characterize them as. When you actually see sharks in the water, they are some of the most graceful and powerful creatures that you can see anywhere on the planet, above or below water. If you think about how we venerate horses, quite rightly so, you see them moving, same with big cats. And the reason, particularly, for example, say tigers, are so well thought of is because they mix that beauty, but they also mix, a definite fear. They play on the combined or the simultaneous feeling that human beings have about the sort of attraction and the danger.
Obviously, the fear and the fascination.
Precisely. And, you know, there's still villages in India that are quite literally terrorized by tigers. Discovery Channel. I know maybe Discovery Channel is not the best place to go to for standard journalism, but there's been several documentaries about these Indian villages that have been terrorized by tigers because the villagers are so poor, they have nowhere else to go. It's their ancestral land. And the land backs into, you know, the forests or woods or the environment of the tigers. And the tigers can know that they can wreak havoc because the villagers have nothing with which to sort of suitably defend themselves. So from there, you sort of go, well, tigers tend to get away with doing whatever they want and they don't get vilified, whereas sharks seem to get all of the opprobrium heaped upon them. There's actually a great clip from the comedian Eddie Izzard, where he does a whole piece about sharks are basically the Nazis of the ocean. And I won't repeat it here because it's just basically just 3 minutes of swearing. But that is the gist of it. And it's kind of like of how to sort of start to change that around to make a sense of the reality of seeing these creatures in their environment and understanding why it is that we're coming into contact with them.
Right.
One of the main characters in Finding Dory is a whale shark who I believe is called Destiny. And whale sharks are the biggest fish in the world. So they can grow up to 18 meters in length, 18 meters. So that really Yikes. Are megalodon size. And the joy of it is, though, is they only eat plankton. They have no teeth. They have very big mouths that filter water, but they have no teeth. So they're completely harmless. They're completely harmless. And
suck you to death.
Yes, exactly. I mean, you wouldn't want to get stuck in one of their mouths. So, that actually, weirdly, they, up until 20 years ago, were very, very elusive as well. It's still every diver's dream to see a whale shark. but it's actually become quite an industry over here that there are several places where, yeah, there are whale shark hotspots where you have a pretty good chance if you go at the right time of year and you pick the right people to go with that you will get to see one. And again, it's the same thing of just how can something so big move with such grace and so fast?
Right.
So they are kind of like the acceptable face of sharks. The sharks it's okay to like.
The acceptable toothless face of sharks.
Yeah, yes. which is, and it's interesting to see that that this is a main character in the new Finding Nemo movie. So I'm kind of hoping that will keep the fluffiness going.
Right, yeah. Before we move on, I've got to mention, you said about them being sort of like perfectly designed and perfect for their environment. You really remind me of, you know that scene in Alien where Ash, the android, admires the alien because it's such a perfect killing machine?
well, yes. I mean, I think if we get into the central reason why is it we fear sharks so much, and it basically seems to come down to a primal terror of being eaten alive. That's what it is. And obviously a great white shark in particular, yeah, when it flips open its mouth, it can actually take you. You know, you would fit inside the mouth of a particularly large grey white shark. So that's all right there. And that's obviously what Jaws played on so cleverly. But the other reason, of course, that we all know why Jaws is such a great movie is because you don't actually see the shark until the last whatever it is, the last 20 minutes. And of course, when it does turn up, it's a bit of a disappointment because it's so obviously fake.
Right, well, and that's why you don't see it until the end of, you know, right. Famously, they were going to feature it a lot more. And then when Spielberg realized that it didn't look at all realistic, they were like, yeah, maybe not.
Yeah, exactly. So your point is right, but I would say not so much about being a killing machine, but that sharks have survived for millions of years.
Survival machine, yeah.
Survival machine, exactly. And also that yeah, obviously we talk a lot now, it's like hundreds of thousands of sharks being killed every year for shark's fin soup. And that's obviously a direct correlation to the sort of burgeoning Chinese middle class, who now obviously can afford what was originally a delicacy. And so more and more people want it as a status symbol. And so therefore that has led to, as I say, hundreds of thousands of sharks being killed every year. And that is now leading to this sort of huge imbalance in the sort of food pyramid of the ocean. Obviously sharks tend to be the apex predators. But if you take away the sharks, then the other species that they keep in check, humans not being one of them, then get allowed to sort of, those other species can sort of grow and grow and grow. And therefore, they start to take over the environment rather than being held in check. And then therefore they cause more problems further down the line, which eventually starts to impact on, different fish species, which obviously human beings rely on as well. So it's one of these things is that, with the ocean sort of, it's out of sight and it's out of mind.
Right, despite the fact that it is such an enormous source of food for humans.
Precisely. And I think as well is that, yeah, we've, since the sort of arrival of industrial fishing methods, which has only been since like the late 1970s, early 1980s, is that that has been a game changer in the terms of how much we can harvest and take out of the ocean. And it's like, you know, so I've spent the last 10 years diving in Asia, and you just, whether you like it or not, you just end up being a reluctant conservationist because you see firsthand what's going on under the water. You see how the reefs get decimated by fishing rods and lines and the trawler nets that they drag across the bottom. And you see how, like when Finding Nemo became hugely popular in Thailand, all of the clownfish disappeared off several of the major national park reefs because they're all taken by people selling them to aquariums.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you get to this point where it's not just one or two, this or that, you know, it's become this industrial complex. And obviously this is one of these things where it gets very sort of tiring to sort of go on and on about it because you just sound sort of like you're hectoring people. Oh, do you know this is happening and blah, 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 blah. But this is the general function of it is that these things are all going on and they're getting worse and worse and worse because there is no real authority or eyes on it. I mean, there are all sorts of movements in place to put things in check, but no one's really keeping any sense of it because the political will is not there because obviously it comes down to the capitalist imperative. It's money. And obviously for a lot of people as well, particularly in Asia, it's their livelihood. You know, they have nothing else to do.
Right. I was just going to say jobs. Yeah.
Precisely. And it's survival. It's, you know, villages in Indonesia, the Philippines don't have much choice. You know, they can't go out and buy fish. They're too poor to go and eat stuff, to go and buy stuff to eat. So they have to go fishing. So,
right. But then again, the people in that situation fishing for themselves, that's not really the issue, is it?
No, absolutely. No, that's quite right. It is, as I say, it's these industrial methods of harvesting the ocean. And so the sharks have weirdly become kind of like the poster child for for that as well. They've become, if you like a warning signal about, you know, what we're doing because it's just not sustainable to keep killing them like this. The interesting thing is as well is about why is shark's fin soup such a big deal? And again, a lot of this comes down to the terror and the fascination that sharks provoke and the kind of glamour that they have. Do you remember the movie, The Cook, the Thief, His Wife and Her Lover by Peter Greenaway? Yeah. There's a line in that movie where the chef is talking about how they price the food. And he said, anything that's black, like olives, we charge twice as much for because it makes the customer feel like they're eating death. And that is exactly what sharks seem to represent to a lot of people, that they are, by eating shark's fin soup, they are conquering the shark itself and they're taking on its power, which is sort of shows how much sharks are venerated, but equally not so great for the poor old sharks as well.
Right, yeah.
But going back to your point about the alien and about being the perfect machine, is that that is the other issue that sharks point towards, is that we know so little about them.
Yes.
Do you think Jaws was shot in 1973, 74? And there was actually a guy called Rodney Fox who was instrumental in the making of the movie, although he doesn't get that much kudos for it. But Rodney Fox is a legend, mainly because he's the guy that was attacked by a great white in 1968, I think. And this is off South Australia. And he was dragged down by the great white. He was on they call it a hooker. It's basically a rubber pipe coming down from the boat, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And it's pumping the air through to him. He was like spearfishing.
Right.
So the great white grabbed hold of him, then started nosediving down through the water, obviously pulling the pipe really tight. And just to the point where Mr. Fox thought that he was going to drown, the shark's teeth severed the cable. And so he managed to sort of come back up to the surface, only to look down through a pool of his own blood to see the shark coming back up for him. And then it took him again and eventually let go of him. And his friends, by some miracle, were nearby on a small boat and got him into the boat. He had something like 400 stitches when they managed to get to a hospital back on the shore. You can see, if you Google Rodney Fox, is the first photo that comes up is how he was stitched back together again. And the stitches are really rough because the doctor didn't think there was any chance he was going to survive the night, but he did. And Rodney Fox went on to become, well, essentially the great white shark's greatest conservationist. He's still alive, bless him. He's still out there running trips off the southern Australian coast with his son, Andrew, who now sort of does all the day-to-day running of it. But it was Rodney Fox who did all the original principal photography for Jaws.
Hmm.
And what they originally did was, the reason Spielberg contacted him was because Fox had been involved in the first couple of movies ever shot underwater at Great Whites, which was the one that got all the attention was called Blue Water, White Death. And that was shot in 1971. And you can imagine, Anthony, it's like that was shot using 16 millimeter cameras in homemade housings to put underwater.
Wow.
It's just, when you read the accounts of this stuff, there's a fantastic book called Blue Meridian. And it gives the account of actually going out to look for the great whites. And they were going to Sri Lanka. And I think they went to a couple of places off Africa, and it was in the end, it was in Australia where they found them. So this is only back at the end of the 60s, and they basically didn't know anything. They didn't know where to find them. They didn't know what it would be like in the water with them. They didn't know what they would eat, all that kind of stuff. So there's no data about the great whites at all. So when Jaws happened, they got this 6-week shooting contract, and they just got this page of instructions, which was go out and make a film of the great whites. First thing you need to do is make it look like there are 3 bullet holes on the great white's skin, like just behind the gills. And they looked at each other and like, how are we going to do that? And there's a couple on the boat along with Rodney Fox called Ron and Valerie Taylor. And Valerie said, I know, strap my lipstick to a stick. And what you can do is get the great white to come up with the bait. And then you can lean over and draw with the lipstick on the back of the shark. I'm not making this up. It is insane. So
the magic of Hollywood.
Exactly. And it's just like, who on earth would even be able to sit there with a straight face and write that in a script direction? It's like, I'm a write with lipstick on there. Brilliant. So this is actually all in Rodney's book called Sharks, the Sea and Me. It's really, really worth reading because there's a whole bunch of other like Jaws anecdotes. But to finish up that particular story was that, so they were doing that. And then the other thing Spielberg said to him is that, right, okay, what we obviously want to do is you want to make the shark look really, really, really big. And we're having all sorts of problems with our mechanical shark. So I want you to find me the biggest real sharks you can and shoot them. And they're like, well, yeah, but we're never going to find a great white shark as big as what you want. And he's like, okay, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to send you a shark cage that is half the size of a normal shark cage. And I'm going to send you a dummy that's about the size of a child. And then I'm going to send you an actor who's a midget, and we're going to put them in the cage. And then when the shark swims by, it will look like the shark is twice as big as it really is because it's going by this tiny cage. And that's actually what they did. They actually had a guy who was 1.4 meters. He was a former jockey. Carl, I believe. Yeah. Who had never scuba dived before in his life.
I was just going to say, like, did he have any diving experience?
He had never scuba dived before in his life. And, yeah, they had to get him. Well, he was freaking out about putting his face in the water. So you can imagine his reaction to, like, getting in a cage and then there's, like, blood and chum on the water and these great whites start turning up. So, yes, you have to read his book for the whole story. But that, that goes to show... That goes to show, like, the level of ignorance, basically, about the sharks even 40 years ago. And, say, Rodney pioneered, like, learning about them. It was off the back of Jaws, actually, that he had the money to start running trips out to. So there's a place called the Neptune Islands, which is 12 hours off the shore of southern Australia. It's really remote. It's essentially a seal colony. So you can imagine great whites love hanging around out there. They love seals. So, but... On the back of that, so he would take out photographers, underwater photographers, and then on the back of that, he managed to found a whole research foundation. So it's only the last 5-10 years that there's been a concerted attempt all around the world to tag great whites. Because again, you'd imagine really, really difficult to get a great white to stay still and have a tag shoved through its dorsal fin. Pretty hard. But yeah, they manage it. So incredibly brave. And obviously they're trying to do it in the least invasive way. And they discovered two things. One is that great whites regularly go to depths of 1,000 meters, 1,000 meters down.
Right, which they thought before that they were exclusively coastal creatures, didn't they?
Exactly. And the other thing was, is that they have proof that one of them, and presumably many of them do, it swam all the way from New Zealand to South Africa and back again. So, which is obviously just thousands of kilometers. And apparently, I would just sort of say, I'm not a scientist, so no one's to send irate emails about you got this wrong. But apparently, the sharks follow the magnetic lines of the Earth. That's how they navigate.
Well, that wouldn't surprise me, because...
Which is just bonkers.
Right, but all sharks can sense electromagnetic fields, can't they? That's one of the few things we do know about them, you know, for sure, is that they all have these, I can't remember what it's called, there's a particular Shatner's bassoon-like name for it. There's this, they have this sensory organ in their snouts that senses electromagnetic fields. So that even if, like, prey are hiding immobile, the sharks can still, they can sense the voltage of their heartbeat. It's amazing.
Yes, exactly. So given that we've only just figured this out recently, it's like, well, what else are these sharks about? Yeah, and also
don't we know about them?
Precisely. Yeah. And, you know, given they have been around there for a million years, you know, one of the most successful creatures in the world, is like, it would be a bit of a shame if they ended just because we decided to kill all them to eat them.
Because we decided they were tasty, yeah. Well, it wouldn't be the first time though, would it?
No, well, that's the joke. I mean, it's not even tasty. I mean, shark's fin soup. Shark's fin obviously is, shark's fin itself is cartilage. It has no taste. It's like the chewy bit of gristle that you get on the end of a chicken.
Oh, so it's not even that it tastes great.
It tastes of nothing. That's the thing, is that is the bit that's so appalling.
Purely about the prestige.
Absolutely. It's sort of believing that that bit of... So there's another really great book just called Shark by... I can't pronounce her surname properly. It's Juliet Ilperin, E-I-L-P-E-R-I-N. And let's call her Juliet because I can pronounce Juliet. She is also a Washington Post reporter. And this book came out a couple of years ago. And she just... She actually goes and spends time with... a couple of guys in Hong Kong who are like the major wholesale shark's fin importers. And like Hong Kong is the sort of ground zero of the shark's fin industry. China is where the huge demand is. Yeah. And Hong Kong, and obviously Hong Kong, there's a lot of money in Hong Kong. I mean, that's certainly where it's been fueled. And then it's sort of percolated into China, Singapore as well. Cause obviously Singapore has a very large Chinese population as well.
Yeah.
For all the doom, you know, I'm Mr. Doom. There are some really interesting signs about how, for example, like the new generation of 20-somethings in Japan are just totally against eating whale meat. Not necessarily in a, oh God, it's so terrible to kill whales, but just in a, that's just really unpleasant. You know, whale meat's right, just not right. Nice. And I'm wondering if this is going to become the same thing in China. It's sort of like, oh yeah, the classic sort of rebellion. Oh, my parents like it, so I don't like it.
Right, it could just be saved by a generational shift.
Yes. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, as long as we haven't killed all of them by then, then exactly, we could have that move. The thing that that Juliet Ilperin points out in her book, though, is that that's the weirdest part, is that you could have shark's fin without any shark's fin soup without any shark fin in it, and you wouldn't even know.
Because it doesn't have a distinctive taste.
Exactly. Yeah. You could just put something else gristly in there, but... No, obviously, no restaurateur worth his name could do that, because he knows if he got caught out, there would just be hell to pay at the end of his
ruinous,
career.
Yeah.
Hello, everyone. Anthony here, just quickly interrupting because I want to tell you about something very exciting. As regular listeners will know, we don't run commercials or sponsorships here on Unjustly Maligned, but many of you have been asking if there is a way to support the show. And I'm now delighted to say that yes, there is. The Incomparable now has a membership system that lets you sign up for a monthly or annual pledge to support this podcast directly. Here's what you do. Go to theincomparable.com/members and sign up for a membership. You'll then be asked to pick the shows on the Incomparable network you'd like to support. So if you just check the box for Unjustly Maligned, your entire contribution will come to us. Well, after admin fees, but you get what I mean. If you listen to other podcasts on the Incomparable network, you can also check their boxes, and your contribution will be shared equally by all the shows that you want to support. As a thank you for your support, members will also receive extras, including exclusive bonus audio tracks, a live bootleg feed of The Incomparable, and other cool stuff. There are contribution levels at $5, $10, and $20 per month, and annual equivalents are available as well. So if you'd like to support Unjustly Maligned, go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up. Thanks very much.
So this goes back to this weird irrationality that we have about sharks. You know, this is the way that we believe this, and then also we believe the killing machine myth. So it seems to speak more about us as human beings rather than the sharks themselves. I mean, how we set them sort of up on a pedestal like this, while at the same time sort of really fearing them, which also points towards, I think, our general fear of the ocean, because the alien reference, I mean, it's not surprising that James Cameron is obsessed with the deep ocean,
you know, right?
That all of his sci-fi movies is that is kind of what he's thinking about. Is not so much, there's outer space, but the ocean is inner space. I mean, if you want real life aliens, just go to the bottom of the Marianas Trench.
Oh God,
there. So, and that's the thing.
That's the irony, isn't it? We talk of space as the final frontier, thanks to Star Trek, but we already have an unknown frontier right here on Earth. It covers most of our planet, and we know amazingly little about it. We're still discovering new species all the time in the oceans.
Absolutely. I mean, in Asia, well, I mean, not particularly surprisingly, because we have the Coral Triangle here, which the Great Barrier Reef is the bottom of, and it runs up in through Indonesia and the Philippines. I mean, they are almost every week discovering just tons and tons of new species of stuff.
Yeah. And as you say, some of them, you know, frankly, you only have to look at a few deep water documentaries of sea life, and some of them are the most bizarre alien looking creatures you've ever seen in your life.
Absolutely. Yeah. And obviously Cameron's The Abyss. I mean, that was,
I think
it's still a wildly underrated movie. I mean, I kind of get why it didn't quite capture the public imaginations as much as it should have, but I thought as a kind of a meditation on the fact that maybe things that are down in the bottom of the ocean aren't necessarily going to kill you all. I thought it was interesting to see such a blockbuster moving in such a thoughtful direction like that. I mean, I'd much rather he made another Abyss movie than Avatar 2. But we got no choice about that.
No, unfortunately not. But I'm with you, yeah. You talked about their sort of grace in the water. And how they are, you know, adapted to sort of perfectly move through the water. Mm. That, funnily enough, reminded me of their major prey, which is, of course, seals.
Yes.
And seals are kind of the same. Seals are incredibly ungainly and, you know, inelegant on land. And then the minute they get in the water, they become the most graceful, agile, beautiful creatures that you could see.
Absolutely. I mean, I mean, when you I was talking about Rodney Fox and cage diving earlier. So 7-8 years ago, I actually went cage diving with Rodney Fox, with his son.
Oh wow!
Yeah, which was it's one of the most remarkable things I've ever done. This is the thing, I've just sat here waffling on about, you know, sharks not killers and yada yada yada. But the moment you're in a cage and you see a great white for the very first time, it's a moment.
Primal fear.
It is, exactly. It's a spare pair of underwear kind of moment. It's that kind of that sort of horror and fascination and fear, and then just suddenly the oh wow, because to watch over a ton of fish just move like it does through the water is quite incredible. And this is what they spend most of their time doing. They're not like battering the cage, and they're not like coming out of nowhere, and they're not sort of gnashing their jaws and in a feeding frenzy. They're just sort of gliding around, checking you out, going back and forth. And of course, they're completely silent. I mean, you know, Cousteau called it the silent world, and they are the epitome of it. It's like how one ton of anything can move without making a sound. It seems impossible, and yet that's exactly what happens. So it's quite unnerving because you're looking out and the water's cold, so it's quite clear. You can see for about 15 meters, and a shark will go by, and you know, you'll follow it, and they'll go off out into the blue. And then, of course, you keep looking in the direction it's gone, waiting for it to turn around and come back, and nothing happens. And then, like, you know, you're sort of looking around a bit more, and then it will appear, almost guaranteed, it will appear from a different corner and a different perspective that you were not looking in.
Right, yeah.
And this is the thing about, this is quite rightly where you should be scared of a great white. I mean, I think it's important to point out that great whites are pretty much unique in the way that they hunt and attack from other species of sharks, particularly the smaller species of sharks, which make up, you know, pretty much all the sharks in the ocean. That great whites, they act like they do the whole checking out thing, and then they essentially just go into the complete overkill. There's no other way to describe it. It's like they usually go for the vertical attack, where they will go down to depth and they will come up like a Polaris missile. And usually it's a seal at the surface that they're going after. So they're not interested in a fair fight. They just go to have you.
And as depicted on the cover of the Jaws book and the poster for the movie. So at least in that sense, that is kind of accurate.
Yes, although the size of the shark in that case is pretty big.
Maybe a little overdone.
But yeah. I mean that is, and when you see that happen, it's at that point you realize that it's like similar to when you see a cheetah bring down an antelope, something like that. Is that the speed and the ferocity and the power and the grace with which these animals can hunt and kill is incredible. And there's no way of separating those things. It's awful, it's horrible, it's terrible, and yet at the same time it's exciting and it's thrilling, and it is exactly what they are built and designed and have evolved to do. And it's kind of like a weird sort of poetry to it. It's quite remarkable. Also, you're seeing a creature just in its own environment, doesn't really care about you, doesn't really even know you're there that much. So you're seeing it, and obviously every time you're present, you're changing the situation a little bit. But as far as it can be, you're just kind of chilled out, because you're not chucking loads of blood in the water and all that sort of stuff. That all that kind of thing is, that's all over now, because they realize that it doesn't really help very much. And
oh, really?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, they tend to use, I can only speak for what I saw in Australia. I mean, obviously there's plenty of different cage diving operations around the world that are better or worse than each other. But in Australia, they just use big chunks of tuna. That's it. And they will use it essentially as a, that they will put on the surface, and they will wriggle it around to attract the shark's attention. And that will
and
be
that's enough.
That's enough. Yeah. But chucking blood and guts in the water, I mean, sometimes they do, but I think on the 5-day trip I did, I think they did it once, and they just said, it's not that great. Plus it stinks.
Well, and that sort of inseparable, you know, beauty and, you know, ferocity, it's the nature red in tooth and claw thing, isn't it? You know, the whole reason that these animals, that we love them and their sort of power, and that they have this power and speed and, you know, sort of grace of movement, whether on land or at sea, whether it's big cats or sharks or whatever, is to make them better hunters. That's why they have these attributes. So it is impossible to separate the beauty and the ferocity, because you can't have one without the other. And when these things attack, as you said, like with a cheetah hunting a gazelle or something, you know, these things are, they're not playing around. They are literally hunting for food. So when they bring something down, they are going to kill it as quickly as they can and as viciously and efficiently as they can, because they don't want to risk anything getting away.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the, I was talking earlier about the primal fear. I think that's part of maybe why safaris are still so popular. And you know, obviously cage diving of great whites is hugely popular, to the point where it certainly is probably in need of more regulation and so on and so forth, but we won't get into that. But it is precisely for this thing of coming face to face with something that is just pure untrammeled nature. You know, there's no interface between it, there's no one sort of pushing the shark out or pushing the cheetah out to go and do something. They're not being goaded into it. You're just seeing something happen. And I think, obviously,
this is 16 million years of evolution.
Precisely, yeah. And obviously, yeah, we all live in the Western world, we all live in a fairly cosseted environment, an increasingly artificial one. And I'm not going to get into the whole, like, oh, it's, you know, I don't think that's a bad thing. But I do think we have hit the point where we are separating ourselves from nature quite effectively. And that when we come back in contact with it like that, it just sets everything blazing, you know, both fear and exhilaration. And it makes people feel alive in a way that they can't quite explain. And it's not in, it's not in the sense of like, oh, I'm putting myself in danger. Like, for example, like, I would happily get back in a cage with great whites, but there's no way you're going to get me on a roller coaster. So, you know, it's just...
That's interesting, because I was going to compare it to roller coasters. I was going to say it's like the roller coaster effect, isn't it? Where the whole, you know, the attraction of a roller coaster is that you do get this exhilarating feeling of almost being in danger, but of course knowing that you're actually not in danger at all.
Sure. But, and I think, if you like, that a roller coaster is, obviously it's a synthetic experience. And I think that's maybe the difference with nature. And obviously all tourism is essentially synthetic. I get that. But that to actually sort of see these creatures moving around, it's like, it finds a connection with you within your own psyche and your own personality about what you're seeing. And obviously it doesn't just have to be sharks. I mean, that's obviously why so many people still love cats, dogs, horses, you know, so on and so forth. That we as humans do have a kind of bond and an affinity with animals, obviously some closer than others. But I think that part to me is that so I've been diving a lot in Asia, and I've been in the water with sharks a lot of the time. Not great whites. Great whites don't live in Asia. The water's too hot. But grey reefs, so on and so forth. Just hundreds of sharks around, and it's not a problem. Never once felt in danger. And obviously, you keep your eye out around and stuff. But they're just in general, they're not. They're just not interested in you. They're scared of you because you're much bigger than they are of you. That you're another predator on the reef that might come for them.
Right, because I think most people don't realise that great whites are kind of exceptional in terms of their size, aren't they?
That's right. I mean, there's only like four species of shark that actually have been dangerous to humans out of the over 100 that exist. And that's great whites, makos, blue sharks and tiger sharks. And the oceanic white tip, which I was about to get to in a minute. So you've got those five, and they all tend to be pretty big. Hammerheads as well, although hammerheads, again, have a really weird reputation of being very dangerous, and yet they're just not. Again, you probably wouldn't want to go and have a fight with one, but, I mean, there's been very, very limited attacks by hammerheads, but I guess they just look particularly fearsome, and they have
the
size.
They do look pretty dangerous, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the thing. For the vast majority of sharks, like, for example, if you go to the Maldives, I mean, the sharks are everywhere there, and they are just a natural part of the reef, and being in the water with them it's not that you get blasé about it, but like I say, I mean, they just become another creature there, sort of thing, and it's very... Right. You know,
well, and most of them, as you say, are smaller than humans, which I think helps.
Yes, and you know, obviously, there are hundreds of thousands of scuba divers in the water these days over the course of any given year, and the number of attacks is zero. In fact, you see all the attacks on people by sharks. A great deal of them seem to be in Florida by bull sharks. And bull sharks are particularly unpleasant because they're a bit stupid. And they are probably the most aggressive sharks of all, and they can swim in fresh water as well as salt water.
Ooh.
So they tend to come into the very shallow areas, and this is where a lot of the attacks happen. They don't see so well. So if people are standing in, you know, cloudy water or whatever, unfortunately, this is the really sad part. It happens, you know, to kids or families that are paddling, that sort of stuff. You would think that the most dangerous thing is in the deep ocean. It's not. It's always within 3 foot of water, close to the shoreline. Statistically, that's basically where most shark attacks happen. So that turns around. And apparently, Peter Benchley was originally inspired by the story for Jaws. I can't remember the name of it, but there was a book that came out about a very famous shark attack in, I don't know, the late 20s, early 30s, that was in that happened outside a town that had a freshwater water source. And they couldn't figure out what on earth was attacking people because no one had figured out that the shark...
Right, they assumed it couldn't possibly be a shark, yeah.
That's right. I mean, I might be mangling that story somewhat, but I know that there was a particular town in the 2030s that had a series of horrific shark attacks, and yeah, that's what led... I think it very probably was a bull shark because that's tends to be what hangs around American waters.
Right. You mentioned the oceanic white tip.
Yes, the oceanic white tip. So just to sort of undo everything I just said, so... the reason I bring it up is because it is the most famous or infamous shark attack story, and it's the story that Quinn tells in Jaws when they're all on the boat swapping war stories, where he talks about being on the warship that went down during World War II, and everyone's lying around the wreckage for 3 days waiting to be rescued, and the sharks just come in and take them, the survivors, one by one. But that's actually true. That's the USS Indianapolis when it sank. But here's the weird part of that. The Indianapolis got sunk at the end of July, just after it delivered the parts for the first atomic bomb. And it was it was it delivered the parts and it was on its way back and it got torpedoed. The writer, Will Self, recently published a book a couple of years ago called Shark. It's an incredible free-flowing... It's one paragraph. The entire book is one paragraph. It just doesn't stop. So it's this incredible sort of Joycean, free-flowing narrative that swaps between characters' perspectives left, right, and centre. But a central hook of the book is that the shark attack on the Indianapolis, where the sharks just circled the wreckage for days, just picking off the survivors, because basically there were sort of 900 people in the water and there's nowhere they could go. There's nothing they could do. So they were the classic shark bait because they were helpless. But Will Self's idea in the book, one of his theses, it was essentially nature's revenge for the atomic bomb being dropped. Yeah, which is cheery.
How very selfie.
Exactly. But that story, I think, actually is what I'm saying and endures Quint. That's the story he relates. And I think, if I remember, he was actually a survivor of that. And I think that is the story, because it really did happen, that has kind of cemented the idea of sharks as being these killers. But in that context, it's kind of like, it's just utterly opportunistic. It's like, if you're floating on the ocean for 3 days and there's blood in the water and people are flapping around and they can't move much and stuff, it's kind of like, that's the laws of nature. I mean, if you were in the desert, something similar would happen to you. If you're in the African plains, something similar would happen to you, right? Something would come for you. It's not like you would...
It's like putting a bunch of people in an all-you-can-eat buffet.
I think we could maybe be a little more sensitive.
But, but it kind of is, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like taking a bunch of hungry people, putting them in an all-you-can-eat buffet, and then, you know, having a go at them when they scoff everything down.
Yeah, absolutely. So like I say, that probably just undoes all the good work I tried to do earlier. But I think it also comes down to this crucial thing, is that we love big cats, even though they can be killers. I mean, look how many dogs in recent years have killed people, usually because they were goaded into it by humans. But dogs have the capacity to kill, and obviously awful stories where toddlers have been attacked and all kinds of stuff like that, and yet we don't go out sort of starting to eradicate dogs, quite rightly so. I think there's definitely a thing though here again about, and again it is about how we think about nature, is that we can't just sort of be selective about what we pick and choose. We can't just always love the cute and the fluffy. Fair enough. I don't think we're going to get many people sort of standing up for cockroaches, but I mean, I think we do need to sort of think about different attitudes or approaches towards beauty, and not everything has to conform to that cute and cuddly aspect. And I'd say sharks for a lot of people are quite incredible creatures. And going back to what I was talking about before, is that here in Thailand, for example, when I started diving here 10 years ago, you would see sharks regularly. It's quite incredible. I used to be a dive guide and like take people to go and see the sharks at one particular pinnacle. And everyone would come back raving about how great it was. They've all gone. They've all been fished out. They've just disappeared. I mean, they just sort of disappeared about 5-6 years ago. Yeah. And it's the saddest thing, because it's kind of like, it's not just an anecdote. It's that it's really happened. And in Thai waters, it's like pretty much all the sharks have gone. Same in Indonesia. They've just been fished out. So, just the short 10 years that I've been diving, seeing all these changes, also seeing coral reefs bleaching. Again, it's been in the news about the Great Barrier Reef bleaching. These changes are real and they're happening. And now, obviously, we can argue about, is it really climate change? Is it human beings doing this? Is it just the natural cycle of the world? And, everything will pop because everything doesn't run on a human timescale. But there's clearly some... a whole bunch of issues there about what we as the human race are doing to the ocean and what we're causing to happen within it, which is ultimately going to come back to us. Unfortunately, this message is so abstract, I think. I mean, I can hear myself saying it and thinking, well, yeah, that's great, but what does anyone do about it? Like, what do you do about it right now? You know, and unfortunately, the answer, there is not much you can do.
Well, I think part of the problem is that, as you said, like, the natural world doesn't really operate on human timescales, but we are affecting change on a human timescale. And that's the problem, is that these changes are happening in, you know, our lifetimes and over such an incredibly short period of time, which the natural world hasn't really seen before.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I think the what I was going back to, so what I was saying earlier about industrial fishing methods, is that that's precisely it. It's that we, with technology, and obviously we've been doing this since the Industrial Revolution, but now we've sort of accelerated to this thing. Yeah, the whole it's Moore's law, right? Everything doubles in speed or whatever. So we seem to have hit that point.
That's not quite exactly Moore's law, but we'll let that go for now.
It's all getting faster, but that's the thing, is as it gets more and more efficient, it's this like what the ocean or indeed like the land, what it could sustain before, it can't do anymore. So I just wonder, I mean, you know, part of me is kind of like, well, it doesn't matter, I'm dead in 30 years, I don't really care. But I wonder, like, what on earth is going to be left next? Because...
Well, that's always been my kind of, not my attitude, but my response to many people about, you know, we're destroying the planet. Well, actually, we're not destroying the planet. What we're doing is destroying a planet that we can live on. You know, the planet will be fine. The Earth is still going to be here. It's just that we won't be on it because we'll have rendered it uninhabitable for humans.
Yes. Yes, that's yeah, that is about
and
the size of it.
And sharks, apparently.
Yeah, the sharks will still be there. They'll be waiting
well,
for
hope.
You.
We hope.
Well, you know, if this Jason Statham movie is to be believed, they're going to be hiding down in a big trench, so just waiting for their turn to come
the
back
megalodon's
out.
Megalodon's rise.
Exactly. Yeah.
Oh God.
There's I mean, you know, there's another movie waiting to be made there. It's like sharks on a boat. It's got to happen, I reckon.
Oh, all right. And on that note, let's bring this to a close. Chris, thanks very much for coming on and educating us all about great whites. Where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
If you want to read more about sharks, you can look at my diving website, divehappy.com. That's dive, D-I-V, not die happy, as some people like to say. I can help with that as well, I guess. And also, you could, if you felt really keen, you could check out my massive non-best-selling book called Thailand's Underwater World, which you can find on Amazon. At the princely sum of $866. I have no idea why it's so expensive.
God bless algorithms.
Maybe you can find a second hand. Who knows? Yeah. But yeah.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. You can check out my comics, books, and music at anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. You can support Unjustly Maligned by becoming a member of the Incomparable Network. Go to theincomparable.com/members to sign up and check the box for Unjustly Maligned when you choose which shows to support. You can also help by reviewing Unjustly Maligned on iTunes and following us on Twitter at UMPFM. Finally, the show notes for this episode are at UMP.fm. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. Thanks for listening and we'll see you next time.
So in South Africa, they have this annual migration happens called the Sardine Run, and which is, as you might imagine, huge shoals of millions of sardines, which form into great big bait balls, and the balls can be up to
seven or eight
meters across, right? So they basically migrate up the coast of South Africa, and for divers, like, this is a mecca. This is like, oh my God, this is something you have to do. Because obviously, with so many sardines, it's like dolphins and sharks just turn up to feast on them. So what you do is you need a guy who knows what he's doing. And you drive out there and you just basically jump in. So you're very shallow. You're in 5 meters of water because the sardines form around near the surface. And then you just basically just hover there and watch the show. And basically at one point I thought I was going to die because like I had this pod of dolphins just heading straight towards me. And I was just like frozen there going, well, you know, it's been good. And of course, they know I'm there. I mean, they just know I'm there. So they just, at the last moment before impact, they all just split around me. You know, they completely navigate. But so I was there with my camera trying to take photos and stuff. I could feel something nudging me from the side. And I was just kind of like, you know what? I'm not even going to look at what might be. And it was incredible and it was scary and I don't think I could do it again. I look back at it, I sort of think, well, what was I thinking? But it was bonkers. But yeah, I mean, the guy who took us out there is this amazing, obviously South African dude, and he'd been doing it for 30 years. And he was kind of like, one person turned up and she had yellow on her wetsuit, like yellow stripes. And he's going, oh my God, didn't you read the email? Like, they hate yellow, they might go for you, you've got to change that, get rid of it, I can't take you out. And like, and he was really serious. It was kind of like, okay, you know, maybe this really, you know, really need to pay attention now to what's going on.
Right, yeah.
So
this is actually quite dangerous.
Yes, exactly. This is actually quite dangerous. Conversely though, the humpback whales are out there as well. So you see them actually breaching, which is obviously incredible. And then at one point he was like, okay, He was like the sort of the water whisperer. He's like, okay, there's a humpback coming. I've just had a, you know, radio signals coming in our direction. It's like, all of you get in the water now. If you're really lucky, it's just going to pass right by you. And we all just looked at each other and you've got to be joking. It's a humpback whale. And he just looked at me, where's your sense of adventure, for God's sake? It's like,
Is it true that sharks have to keep moving? Is that just a myth?
No, it's not true. It's not true. Some of them do and some of them don't. And I looked this up, actually weirdly, I looked this up just a couple of weeks ago and now I've completely forgotten again. It's in that Shark book by Julia O'Fearon. She actually talks about it.
Right.
I think maybe the biggest ones do just because they're so flipping big. But for example...
But then how do they sleep?
I don't know. Marine biologist.
Well, I just you go, might know.
I just, well, I do. I did know, and then I forgot. I gotta ask a scientist if I need things to know things like that. I just write the words.
Do you realize, and I have some sympathy here, do you realize that you have adopted American pronunciation of words with T in the middle?
No.
You are pronouncing all your T's as D's. Yeah, I do that when I've been in the States for a while. I can't help it. So you keep saying water instead of water. And you said reporter at one point as well.
How bizarre.
But exactly. You don't realize you're doing it. My missus hates it. I got back from Emerald City Comic Con, which is in Seattle. After I'd been there, I had a little bit of a vacation around it a couple of years ago. So I was there for about 2 weeks and I came back and we were just sort of chatting in the car on the way home after she picked me up. And I kept referring to it as Emerald City and it drove her absolutely bonkers. She was like, stop saying that. You are not American.
Whose language is it anyway? You know, English now.
Right.
I mean, soon we're going to be at the point where more Chinese speak English than Americans. So yeah, it's, That's another thing of just the flux.
That's going to be a very strange day, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, obviously living over here, it's like that's kind of already happened. I don't mean Chinese, but you know, I'm surrounded by people that speak English that have learned it from America or taught themselves or learned it off the TV or, you know, so you have all kinds of different accents. There's a huge Thai Indian population here as well. So Filipinos come here now to teach English, and Filipinos have got their own particularly like lyrical, poetic way with English. So it's really interesting. I mean, it's a very, it's kind of fascinating to see it as how alive as a language it is and how mutable it is. I think that's why English, even though it's so bloody difficult to learn, it's why it just keeps thriving, because everyone can bend it to what they want.
Right. Well, it's the whole thing about like English being one of the best languages for music. One of the reasons English is like the universal language of songs and music is because of the ways it can be used in non-strictly grammatical ways and still make sense.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. And that's the thing as well that I really love about being over here, is I love seeing how English gets broken down and put together again in ways that I just wouldn't ever do, because, you know, I was about to say, because I'm a native speaker, but I don't think that actually even that's particularly relevant. It's just that because I grew up in England from a certain time period, and now I'm over here, and it's 40 years on. And
it's culture as much as language.
They're pulling the language apart and rebuilding it as they want. And it's kind of like, wow, it really fascinates. I mean, I don't necessarily always like it, but it really fascinates me. I certainly don't feel like I'm allowed to correct people. I'm old.
And also that would be rather colonialist of you.
Well, it would, yeah. But I do have my pink gin here, though, so you know.
Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, marine mammals, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston. I just realised they're not mammals, are they? I'll do them again. I'm thinking of whales.
I was about to pipe up and go, no, just let him carry on. Never apologise, never explain.